The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
I need you to knock some sense into me. I'm sure you can.
Yeah, I don't know.
I enjoy listening to you. I don't always agree with everything.
All right, enough of this persiflage.
So, you want my question?
I'm certainly not going to get myself in trouble by telling you what to do.
That makes great sense. Gosh, that's good.
That I overwhelm you with words and wisdom?
I've got 7 kids. I feel like I could call you every day.
Wait, you're telling me I'm wrong? Disconnect.
Yes, I am, Dr. Ray.
You just need to tune in to Dr. Ray, honey. He's got all the answers.
Am I right or am I right?
Probably.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
Persiflage, a playful repartee, a banter. Very nice to have you here with me on The Doctor Is In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time, co-production, EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Ave Maria Radio Communications. This is Look Back Friday, a variant of the program that came out of my mild frustration, because many calls I wanted to talk a lot more about. Obviously, this is not therapy here, nor diagnosis, but there are just thoughts and ideas that could be shared. However, because of the exigencies of radio and the time, you can't go on and on and on because there are people waiting patiently. That said, I wanted to find a way that I could bring up another point or two about the call or define a word that was used in the call that shot right by us. And I thought to myself, if I interrupt and try to define the word, then we're off track. So I saved those calls for Look Back Friday. And that's what this is about. So we have some calls up there from previous programs that I'm going to embellish, talk a little bit more about, hopefully add to and not subtract from. So we will get to those. Do you have a phobia? What is a phobia? Is it any fear? Is it a dislike? I don't like riding roller coasters. They make me queasy. I avoid them. Do you then have a phobia of roller coasters? I get nervous around big dogs. Even if it's a big dog in a friend's house or a relative's house, I get ill at ease. Do you not go to your friends then? Do you not go to your friends even if killer is chained outside? Just won't go. Now you're starting to flirt with a phobia. A phobia is a fear, usually of something particular. It's not a general kind of fear. It is, for example, I just don't want to drive on the interstate. It's too fast. Cars buzzing by me. I'm going 60 and they're blowing by me like I'm standing still. And there's so many of them and I have to merge. And I have to merge and try to figure out how to get in there. So you don't have a fear of driving per se. You have a fear of driving in a particular place. Or a particular journey. So, one, a phobia is a specific fear. What is the difference? If you're fearful of something, when does it become a phobia? It becomes a phobia when it constricts your behavior. For example, many people do not like snakes. But for the most part, unless you live in the Everglades or the rainforest or certain places in Africa, you're not likely to stumble upon a snake. So they don't really constrict your life all that much. On the other hand, let's say that your 16-year-old son brings in a garter snake that he found out in the field, and you absolutely go berserk, freak out, screaming, get it out of here, get it out of here, get it out of here. Now, that might be a reaction so extreme to something that really is not threatening that you could call it a phobia. Or let's say that your fear of snakes is so inhibiting that if you go to the zoo, you're not even going to go anywhere near the reptile exhibits. You're going to walk away around them, thinking to yourself, well, yeah, I know they're behind glass, but you never know. I mean, you know, I've read stories where these things can get out. Okay, now it's constricting you. So a phobia is a particular fear, and it's extreme enough, it's disproportionate to the actual threat, and it inhibits your freedom. It's legitimate to be afraid of a mean, ugly dog who looks like he wants to hurt you. That's legit. But if it's a 22-pound mutt who just comes jogging up to you and you get very ill at ease because this dog is too near your leg, which, by the way, just as an aside, do you know who bites more often? The little dogs. I know it. The little dogs are much more likely to nip at you. Maybe they're trying to show their toughness. Either way. Now, a phobia for many people is just something that they will avoid. I will not get on an elevator. No, not me personally, but let's say you will not get on an elevator. So that is somewhat constricting, and you really can't go too many floors above the ground floor. If you're in a hotel, you got to get a room on the second, third, fourth floor. You don't want to start getting one on the ninth. Or if you're on a cruise ship, those things are floating cities. They've got 12, 13, 14, 15 decks. And the sad thing of it is the buffet is at the top deck. Oh, man. Well, if you don't want to get on an elevator because you just feel too constricted and people too close and people in your space and nervousness about the thing moving and what if it breaks and what if we get stuck on it and you talk yourself into an extreme sense of fear, that's pretty constricting. That'll probably keep you off cruise ships. And if you can't find a room on the second, third, fourth floor of a hotel, then you have to leave. So, in fact, a phobia can do a number on your personal freedom. If it doesn't, let's say that you are ill at ease around bees. Bees just, And you're not allergic to bees, so it's not something that you legitimately have to care for your personal well-being. You just something about these things just really bother you. All right, so you avoid going too close to flowers. And for the most part, you're okay. You could be sitting outside on your deck or your patio, and you see a bee floating around, and you head for the house. All right. So in that sense, it does constrict some of your freedom, but for the most part, if there's no bee around, you're allowed to go outside. Specific fear. Irrational. It's irrational. You're afraid of something that has really no serious danger to hurt you, and it constricts you. I had a friend once who told me about her fear of escalators. Escalators. Why escalators? Elevators are much more prominent places of phobias developing. Why an escalator? Anything bad ever happen on one? No. I asked her with my tongue in cheek. I said, well, did Did one ever break down with you right in the middle of it and you were stranded for 3 hours on that escalator? And she looked at me and she said, no. And then it hit her and she started laughing. How can you be stranded on an escalator? They just become stairs. You just walk up or down. Nevertheless, the few times she tried to step back on that escalator after she got up about two or three steps, she got hit with a full-fledged anxiety wave. So she just avoided escalators. You could develop a phobia to just about anything. What is usually necessary is some kind of traumatic experience. You got bit by a dog. Or you were stuck for 2 hours on an elevator until they came and get you off. It's true. So you had a bad experience that paired in a classical conditioning sense, as they would call it in behavior psychology, an emotional reaction, a severe emotional reaction, fear, with a particular place or situation. All right, that's a root cause often. Sometimes it's just in your head. You conjure up a potential fear that has never really happened to you, but you're wondering if it could. You've never really been bitten by a dog. But that possibility is there. However it might be remote, it is there. So in your mind, you create a scenario that is dangerous and to be avoided. If you have a fear of your uncle's German Shepherd, and that's really the only dog you don't want to go around because he just seems intimidating. I don't know if that would be a phobia. That's just a specific, targeted, particular dog. But if you're afraid of pretty much any dog, now you're getting into the realm of a phobia. A phobia is, it's language is what it is. Is it a fear? Is it a phobia? Depends upon the degree. Depends upon how much it affects your life. It depends upon all the things you do to avoid it. Depends upon how inconvenient it can get. How do you conquer a phobia? Believe it or not, it's repeated exposure. You rewire your emotional reaction. You recognize that I have to prove to my brain, my amygdala, which is one of the centers of protective emotional fear reactions, you rewire it and you show it there is no danger there in this phobic place. There's no danger. As you do that, as you float through the phobia, as you sit in the kitchen and you let Uncle Fred's dog sit 9 feet away from you, initially looking at you and then after that not paying any attention to you, and you gradually ease your anxiety. You do that a few times and you could succeed in maybe not being comfortable around his dog, but not so constricted that you won't go anywhere near his house. Pretty much everybody has a phobia at some point in their lives. People have phobias of dentists. That's a very common one. Needles. Oh, that's huge. Needles is huge. Elevators. The biggest phobia by far of all, and this is why I get paid the big bucks when I do it, public speaking. They estimate that 75% of people panic at the thought of having to get up in front of a group, large or small, and speak. The thought of it alone makes them very, very nervous. Public speaking. What is it about public speaking? There's no danger in public speaking. Nobody's going to throw anything at you, I don't think. Nobody's going to bite you like a dog would, unless you're walking up to the podium and somebody takes a bite out of your ankle. I don't know, but public speaking is nothing but the fear of what I'm going to look like in front of all these people, what I might do in front of all these people, whether they see my shallow breathing in front of all these people, whether I lose my place in front of all these people. Public speaking, isn't that interesting? What is it about the human condition that that is the number one phobia? And again, the more people who can't do it, the better pay for the people who can, like me. What am I afraid of? What would I have a phobia of? I'd have to think about that. All right, I'll share with you this one. I know I'm going a long time, but this is Look Back Friday, so I wanted to talk about this. I was asked about a year and a half ago to be a lector at Mass to get to read either the first or second reading. Oh, cool. This is good. I like to do that. I'm used to reading stuff publicly. Do it on the radio here. Do it on TV. This is easy. First Sunday, getting ready to read while I was sitting in my pew, I was very nervous. What? I'd given thousands of speeches and presentations. Why? Why is this happening now? So I pondered it, and I realized one was a new venue. I mean, I've never actually read scripture before a live audience. Brand new venue. Two, the words are not mine. They're God's. I wanted to say them right. My tempo, my pacing, my pronunciation of the really difficult stuff, like especially that one chapter in Acts where they say, we are Parthians and Medes and Cappadocians. And they list all these people from the various regions. Like, oh, man. Because I used to listen to lectors butcher up those words. And I talked myself into being nervous. What if my hands shake? What if I get breathy? What if I lose my place? If I try to look up and make eye contact? After about five or six Sundays of reading, I was perfectly into my comfort zone again because I realized none of that stuff was going to happen. But even if it did, it wasn't the crisis that my mind was telling me it was. So yeah, that's probably the closest thing I've had to an unexpected fear reaction. Phobia. Psychology word. For an irrational fear, particular person, place, thing, circumstance, that constricts one's existence. Sometimes a lot. Dr. Ray.
Hi, I'm Angie. Did you know a billboard can save a baby's life? It's true. You can make a difference this holiday by helping us spread the pro-life message to reach those who are struggling with an unplanned pregnancy. Our billboards and ads feature our 800 hotline for help, which connects people to pro-life centers nationwide that can assist with free medical help, baby supplies, and more. Won't you join us in this season of giving? Please make a gift today. Visit ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org. That's ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing our pilgrimage to charming Ireland and its rich Catholic heritage. The shrines are nestled in the quaint Emerald Isle. Lovely people, marvelous food, sweeping vistas. Everyone's favorite is Mass at Our Lady of Knock and its Eucharistic apparition. We hope you can join us in August, along with our Irish chaplain, Father James Conlon.
To learn more about your Ave Maria Radio trip, find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town, where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. That's AveMaria.com.
Thank you.
nice to have you with me. I am realizing that I need to be transparent. That's what they told me in psychology school. You got to be transparent. You got to recognize your weaknesses. All right, I'm being transparent. Andrew Grucek, at the last minute, my producer man, and the man who edits these look-back calls, little guy got sick, his son got sick. So he was called away after only editing two look-back calls. So I said to Eric Dumont, who is substituting right now, Eric, that's okay. It's okay. I will do a longer monologue, and then we'll have the two calls throughout the rest of the program. Well, Eric pointed out to me that I did a long monologue, a really long monologue, about phobias and fears. And he said, when you come back, Ray, you're not going to have enough time to get this call in and then comment on it at all. Okay. So what I will do is I will just make a few more comments about phobias and fears. And then after that, I will go to Susie, who is wondering what is going on. Why is she being shunned by her daughter? Now, this is such a common thing nowadays, very sadly. But she seems to be at a loss as to why this is. So a few more comments about phobias. Most people live with them. They do. They don't generally put themselves in the position of experiencing that level of anxiety. They will find a way to live around it, whatever it might be. If it's elevators, I won't go any building that I have to climb more than 3 or 4 flights. That's it. If it's snakes, I won't put myself in any position where a snake could be within 2 miles of me. Unbeknownst to me, that is. However, there sometimes are situations where a phobia can badly, badly, badly constrict you. When I was a young shrinkling, my supervisor told me a story about a businessman who had always had uneasiness on elevators, but his uneasiness was, how shall we say, going up into full-fledged anxiety that he thought was somewhat unbearable. However, because he was a fairly high up in his organization person, more and more meetings were on upper floors of large, high buildings. And this definitely was going to put a crimp in his ability to function in his job. Seriously, threatening it. So my friend described to him what he was doing to himself. He was creating a fear in his head, and he was, in fact, avoiding the fear. And when you avoid the fear, you just make it worse, is what happens. You feel immediately relief, but in the long term, you make it worse. So this guy was real rational and hard-nosed. He said, you mean I'm doing this to myself? My friend says, yeah, in some respects you are. So he went out and he hired a guy to take him up and down on an elevator and not let him out. And he wanted to experience it the whole time, however long it took, until his anxiety abated. And it will abate. You can't stay anxious forever. And it abated. He was hard-nosed enough. He said, okay, I got to get over this. I'm going to expose myself to the fear. I will live through it. I will float through it. I will not try to gut it out. I will just simply recognize this is anxiety. It's not going to hurt me. And he did. He conquered his fear. Took him about an hour or two riding that elevator. But he did. He exposed himself to his fear. Found out that the anxiety wasn't going to hurt him. It was an extremely unpleasant state, but it wasn't going to hurt him. And he knew that. He believed my psychologist friend. And he did it.
'60 on 10 with Monsignor Charles Pope.
The Eighth Commandment.
you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. At one level, the reputation a person has is one of their most precious gifts, and to intentionally harm the good reputation of someone is a very grave matter. We can do this often through detraction, by disclosing others' faults without a valid reason, or calumny, just outright lying about other people. Likewise, through rash judgment. This commandment also protects the truth, which is another very, very great good. To lie is to speak something that we know is false with the intention of deceiving others. We ought to be dedicated to the truth. It is the truth that sets people free, while errors and lies entrap people in many difficult and often sinful situations. The Lord asks us to give witness to the truth of the gospel. This commandment therefore asks us to stay dedicated to the truth and to other people's reputation. The eighth commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor.
For more about the Ten Commandments, visit EWTNRC.com.
The arguments raging in today's society as to the state of marriage and who may enter into it shouldn't cause us to forget its permanent characteristics. According to the Catholic Catechism, the matrimonial covenant has two main purposes: the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. Our Lord Jesus raised this covenant to the dignity of a sacrament. The Catechism also reminds us of the indisputable fact that marriage is not a purely human institution. God Himself is the author of marriage, and only God, not man, can change its common and permanent characteristics. It began with the creation of man and woman in the image and likeness of God, who is love. Thus, their mutual and unfailing love becomes an image of the absolute and unfailing love with which God loves man. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Okay, back to the purpose of Look Back Friday. Susie from Oregon, is being shunned. By her daughter. Well, you ain't allowed to talk to your daughter anymore.
Yes, and I'm not going to cry, but it's very upsetting. They put me on a pretty restricted phone schedule, and before it all went down, and I was just wanting flexibility and more time with her, and it's my first child out of the house and married and all that, and so I'm just trying to figure it out, so. And now they cut me off altogether. It's been 5 weeks since I've spoken to her. And
are you saying that they, even at the start of the marriage, put you on a phone limit?
Yes. After their honeymoon, they didn't want to talk to anybody during their honeymoon, so I tried to follow that, just texting, not intrusive. And then after their honeymoon, they put me on a pretty strict. It's Wednesdays at 8 o'clock in the morning, and for 30 minutes.
No explanation.
That they really wanted me to respect their time together, and that was it.
Is there anything about your personality, your religious views, your traditionalism? Anything like that they've decided we can't relate to any of that anymore, Mom?
No. They're both pretty faithful Catholics. And it's just strange because she's never been... We've always had a good relationship. And that I just can't help but think that it's just him.
Could be. Could be the explanation, that she's feeling the pressure. He doesn't like you for some reason, or he's insecure about his relationship with her, and he wants her all to himself. I don't know. I'm just wildly speculating. So as far as you know, you didn't say or do anything that could be misinterpreted by them to say, okay, well, we better just put her at a distance.
Well, during the wedding, during the planning of the wedding, we've had some disagreements of, you know, venue and, you know, things like that. I just feel like he's pretty controlling.
And he probably feels you were.
Yes.
Okay.
I would agree with that, that he feels that way.
All right. So that explains that. Now we do damage control.
Yes.
I would text your daughter and say, I fully want to respect whatever conditions you both have. Let me know if and when we can talk again. But until then, I will simply respect it, and I won't make any efforts to contact you until you decide you're ready.
Okay.
That's what I would do. And she may come to the point where she says, you know what, it's been 3 months. And I know that he wants me to put my mother out of our lives, but I'm not going to do that. That's my mom. What have I been doing here? This is wrong. She hasn't bothered us. She hasn't called when she's not supposed to call. She didn't keep trying. Yeah, I think right now, Susie, if you keep trying, it's just going to push him further away. And I don't know what her motive is. And I see this a lot in marriage counseling, where you've got one of the spouses who feels pressured not to contact their own parents because of what the other spouse wants. And they yield. They have to live with that spouse, so they yield to it. But after a while, they say, wait a minute. This has gone on long enough. So I think what I would do is give them room, Susie. And probably if I talk to your daughter or your son-in-law, they would say, well, let me tell you what she did during our wedding that we had about enough of. That's probably how they interpreted it. Even though you didn't mean anything by it, how they interpreted it. I know why I picked this as a look back call, because of two common variables in these dynamics. The first one is, at the beginning, initially in the relationship, perhaps, the parent with the young adult son or daughter gets into some either disagreements, differences of opinion, unwanted instructions, guidance, comments, whatever. Now, if the relationship is healthy and mature, it is not damaged by it. Matter of fact, they even grow by it. However, if the relationship between that son or daughter and the spouse, their spouse, one or both of them, is not, it's not real stable. One or both of the spouses is immature or intolerant, insecure, takes whatever the parent is offering as criticism. Notice that Susie said, yeah, there were some disagreements. Well, I don't know the extent of those disagreements. I don't know how ugly they were. I don't know how long they went on. I don't know what big things or little things they were over. But what probably happened, no matter what, is that the son-in-law, initially unbeknownst to Susie, was getting more and more upset. I don't like your mother's intrusiveness. We didn't ask your mother for her opinion. I don't like the fact that she's trying to tell us how to do this. I don't like the fact that she has given us options. I just don't like this. Now, someone who's wanting to get along with their spouse would recognize, yeah, okay, that's your mom. All right, I'm going to float with her. I'm going to tolerate it. It's no big deal. We'll work it out. That's who she is. But that's not what happens if you got a spouse that can be difficult or insecure, taking things too sensitively, too personally. And then when the parent doesn't read it correctly, in other words, They didn't pick up on it the first disagreement, not the second, not the fourth, not the ninth. They finally picked up on it about disagreement number 12, or comment number 12, or opinion number 12 that wasn't taken. Then they realized, oops, I am not being viewed well by this adult person. I see that all the time. And Susie kind of admitted it. She said, we had some disagreements back when they were planning for the wedding. And I said, yeah, you think he's controlling, but he probably thinks you are. She goes, oh, yeah, he does. So that's his way of saying we didn't want what you were giving us in terms of instruction or opinion or perspective. We don't want it.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jangle.
In the third rule of the Discernment of Spirits, St. Ignatius of Loyola teaches that one of the experiences of spiritual consolation includes every increase of faith, hope, and love. Every baptized Christian receives the supernatural gifts of faith, hope, and love through their baptism. Through spiritual consolation, the gift of feeling stronger or deeper faith, hope, and love increases and has a recognizable intensity within a person's interior spiritual experience. There is a before and after effect. Before the gift of the spiritual consolation, a person may be exercising faith, but then after receiving the grace of a spiritual consolation, the person feels their faith increase in a perceptible way. This is true regarding increases of hope and love as well. Let us ask God to grant us every increase of faith, hope, and love precisely when we need it.
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
Are you passionate about Jesus? Are you zealous for Jesus? Are you fervent for Jesus? Are we fervent for the gospel? Are we passionate about helping this world come to know him? Is that true? It's not true for most people in the church. Is Jesus my best friend? Is he your best friend? I'm looking around the church. There's a set of guys in here who have great man caves. As I was praying this morning, I felt like the Lord said, hey, when are you going to come to my man cave? Like, you guys think a flat screen TV is really cool. Well, you should see what I got to offer. Because I and I alone, he says, can really give you what it is you're longing for. Whoever it is we're rooting for right now, they're going to lose eventually. Or whatever it is that's occupying our time, one day we're going to realize it really wasn't that important. Why aren't we hanging out with the one who alone can show us what life is really all about? When's the last time you hung out in the Lord's man cave?
More comments on Susie's situation. It's tragic because typically it is easy to underestimate or to not notice when an adult child doesn't want what you have to say about their child rearing, about their choice of houses, about their religion or their lack of religion. Or their wedding plans. They don't want it. And oftentimes that's an in-law. The in-law doesn't have the history with you that the adult child does, so maybe the in-law might be a little less willing to tolerate this. It rankles them more. And unfortunately, if you don't notice that's happening, you can continue thinking, well, what I'm offering is helpful, what I'm offering is benign. What I'm offering should be accepted. It's not any big deal. I'm not insulting anybody. I'm not doing anything that a reasonable person would think is ugly and intrusive. Yeah, but you underestimated how it was going to be interpreted. The insecurity on the other end. That's a dynamic that is so repeated among these kinds of situations where the parent says, my adult child who's married has now limited me. They don't want to see me. They've cut off the grandkids. And I do find that in a very high percentage of the time, it is because the adult child is intolerant, immature, doesn't allow the parent to be, well, if you will, obnoxious. It's true. Dr. A, there are some parents you just have to put distance to. I understand it. I agree with that. These are people who are high risks to your family's well-being or your well-being. But that is not the majority. The majority is, I find this person unpleasant or difficult at times. I find this person giving opinions that aren't asked for. I find this person trying to tell me how to run my life. Okay, you can ignore it. But you don't have to run them out of your lives. Unfortunately, that's the option that many pick. Tony from Florida is concerned about his son. His son is depressed, as Tony sees it anyway, and is stuck in the proverbial rut.
I'm calling about, I have a son, he's 30 years old. When he was finished high school and he was going to state college, his friends got their AA and he was short of getting his. They went to a four-year program. We allowed him to go up there with him. They were good kids, and finish getting his 2-year at the local state college there, and then to get into the 4-year program, which he said he did. He was in it, you know, in the 4-year program. Anyway, eventually we found out he was lying to us. He never got into the 4-year program. He lied to us about it. He was taking classes, dropping out of them, never even, you know, I think barely finished his 2-year or was right there. And when we did, we brought him home. His GPA was low, so he couldn't even take a full line of classes, had to take 2 classes. But he brought him home. He was in school. He did well. He was getting good grades. And then working part-time. He got to a point where he could take full-time, got his GPA up, and he was doing that. Then he stopped short of probably about 4 classes of getting his 4-year degree. He was working full-time at a place he worked there for 3 years, decided he didn't like it, wanted to just flat-out quit, trying to talk to him about quitting, having another job in place, et cetera. I was able to get him a job with a family member who had a company local nearby, and so he took that, and he kind of said it was a trial program, did it for about a month or so, and he ends up, I get a call, and he hadn't come to work in 2 days, and they couldn't reach him. And my son called him and found out, you know, and that morning had told my mom, my wife, that his mom, that he was on his way to, you know, work, because she had seen that there was an accident on the main highway. So anyway, he was lying to us. He ended up finally, you know, telling us. And he called and he quit.
Bring me up to date here, Tony. Bring me up to today.
Yeah. So right now, he's always kept this other job that he's had, and he lives on his own. He doesn't ask us for money or anything like that. I don't believe he's doing any drugs or anything like that. I can't say 1,000% for sure, but I don't feel he is. He distanced himself a little bit from the family, but he's close to the family. He's making an effort to be back with us, and when we have family things and everything.
So,
and,
Tony, what is your concern?
Okay, so my concern is that, you know, again, he didn't, the first time it was, I felt like he was in a depression, you know, he was like sleeping in, he didn't want to go to work. The job he quit, he was so distraught about it, but it wasn't anything horrible. He just didn't like it there, but it was like he was so distraught, he was having a hard time getting up and going to work.
So your son has made a lot of bad decisions for years.
Correct. And it's like, I don't know if it's a depression. We did. He went and saw a psychiatrist one time, and he told him he had mild depression. So that's, you know, that's where that is. And we're trying to get him to see a therapist now.
Okay.
But I don't, you know, I'm just concerned that, you know, I mean, it's just more than he makes bad decisions. He's depressed over it.
I wouldn't doubt if there's some kind of depressive mood filtering through his decisions because he makes bad decisions. He quits jobs. He finds himself without money. He maybe doesn't get along with a boss or a coworker because he gets frustrated easily. So he does these kinds of things. Does he have a girlfriend?
No, not a steady one. You know, he feels like he, one of the things, I mean, he does have girls that, you know, like he's dating. He's talking to this one girl that he admits are kind of So it's not, I wouldn't say it's a point at the end of a girlfriend thing or not, but he also feels like he's not in a position to, you know, because of his, you know, life decisions. He really recognizes that things, but he's not happy in these other jobs.
And well, it's not surprising. He
works at a very simple job. He's happy at that.
Well, he sees that anything that pushes him a little bit to act a certain way is a challenge and it bothers him. So he retreats from it. But in retreating from it, he doesn't move forward at all. He works a dead-end job. And he, as you were beginning to say, he doesn't know if he can keep a girlfriend because he doesn't have much money. So all of this is on top of him. And you're right. A good therapist, hopefully, will help him look at what he's doing and say, these are dead-end decisions. I've had a lot of guys come to me like this. Unless they are willing to say, for years, I've made a lot of bad decisions based upon a lot of bad thinking. And I want to look at that, and I want to do something about it. Unless they're really willing to do that. It's kind of like losing weight. Yeah, I want to lose weight. Well, okay. Well, I'm not sure I want to do all I have to do to lose weight. You mean watch my intake and maybe get a little more active? Ooh, I don't know about that, but I still want to lose weight. So if that's where your son is, I don't know how much therapy is going to help him. Which came first? The bad decisions and the depressive mood? Or the depressive mood leading to the motivation and the bad decisions? My experience as a clinician is that more often than not, whatever level of depression is present is a result of living life in a way that is frustrating, dead end, easily drifting. Tony says his son gets frustrated easy. He doesn't like the job. Maybe he doesn't want to get up. He gets bored. Doesn't want to do this. So he quits. Well, until he has another, maybe better job, which Tony says, I try to tell him, don't quit before you get another job. But he quits anyway because I can't take it. Well, he sees that at age 30, wherever he might be in life, financially, socially, with women, he's not very far along. Doesn't own much. Just kind of moving through life, making a way, but it isn't much of forward progress. So it bothers him. He's depressed about it. But the root of it, the things that he needs to do to get over the depression, actions, working the job, tolerating the frustration of the job as he looks for something better for him, he pulls the trigger too quick. He leaves. And he finds himself pretty much in the same situation that he's found himself the last 10 years. He got frustrated at college, so what did he do? He started lying about whether he was going to class or not. And he lied to his mom about whether he was going to work that day or not, and he disappeared effectively for 2 days. He knows what he's doing, but he keeps doing it. As I said, I drew the analogy to someone who is just absolutely distressed over the amount of weight they've allowed themselves to gain. They're uncomfortable with it. They don't like the way they look. They feel bad. It has all kinds of effects on their personality and their emotions and their level of easy movement physically. They very much want to be lighter. But taking the concrete steps to be lighter, which would lift a lot of their struggles with their emotions, they don't do. Because it requires them to motivate themselves beyond what they've been doing. And I think that's a lot of it with Tony's son here. He's so typical of a lot of guys, a lot of people, a lot of young adults who simply I just don't like the way life's gone. I can make it drifting along. I'll be okay. I won't really have a whole lot, but I can still make it. And that's the pattern that they head into, but then they're surprised when they're depressed about it. Seeing that depression is the natural outcome of it. It's not the cause of it. It's not, I'm depressed, therefore I don't want to go to work. It's, I don't have a regular work life. I don't have a regular motivation to work, so therefore I quit. And then that brings complications, which I get depressed about. Making good decisions is not easy. There's only one thing harder. Don't make good decisions. I'm Dr. Ray.
We'll return after these messages.
Life can be overwhelming, leaving you feeling anxious, alone, or even in despair. That's why the nonprofit Revive app was created, to help you navigate the darkness and discover the light. With Revive, confidential conversations with a certified spiritual companion are always just a tap away. And right now, your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3. Let them help you find joy in tomorrow.
Advent is here, and Ave Maria Radio wants to walk beside you every day as we move towards the birth of Jesus. When you visit AveMariaRadio.net, you can join our Advent mission and receive short, powerful, and engaging daily videos that help you enter the mystery of the Incarnation with new clarity and devotion. Go to the slider at AveMariaRadio.net, sign up, and take your place in this joyful journey to the manger.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Have you ever been so grief-stricken and so heartsick that you can't see God? You can't see God in the tragedy. You can't see God in that cross. You can't see God in that sin. Why? You're enveloped in that grief. You're enveloped in fear. And God is out the window. You don't see Him standing right next to you.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Don't have, of course, any more time for a look back call, and really not a whole lot of time for me to comment on look back calls, but I want to comment a little bit more on Tony's son, who at age 30 is still kind of bouncing around, drifting around, and not liking the trajectory of his life. There's an old term in psychology regarding depression. It was called reactive depression. It basically meant there was a situation, circumstance, incident that caused someone to go into a depressive state beyond the natural reaction to this. For example, say somebody got fired from their job, and certainly being disappointed about it, they shut down. They shut down. They started sleeping. They didn't look for another job, and it affected their life for some time, months. Reactive depression. What I see a lot more of is this kind of low-level depression, which is a result of a series of decisions that in the short term, the person thinks are going to relieve their frustration. I don't like this job that I have, so I'm just going to quit it and I'll feel better. Well, no, you won't, because now you don't have a job and now you have to look for one and it may not be easy. So you traded one set of frustrations for a new set and you get depressed. You get bothered by it. And as that goes on and you pile one of these kinds of decisions upon another, your companion seems to be a general discontent, almost a despair a little bit, because what am I doing? I don't know why this is happening to me. Why do I feel this way? And if you don't have enough insight to realize you're doing this by this chain of decisions that you're making, then you'll look at your depression and you'll think, yeah, I think my problem is I'm depressed. That's what it is. No, you got to look further back to see the reasons for this emotional state. Got to run. Thank you for joining me. Thanks, Eric Dumont. Walk with God. That'll help with being less depressed most times.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit drray.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.